I'm Jessica Levinson. I'm a professor at Loyola Law School and the vice president of the LA Ethics Commission. I'm pleased to be sitting in for Ian Masters today for background briefing. Today, we'll be speaking with Professor Lori Levinson, also a professor at Loyola Law School, talking about the Project for the Innocent. We'll be speaking with Fran Siegel, who's the chief investment officer and managing director of Impact Assets. And finally, we'll talk to Carla Marinucci, a senior political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, about the 2014 elections. But now I am so pleased to introduce Lori Levinson, a professor of law at Loyola Law School, where she holds the David Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy. The show is only an hour, so we don't have time for the complete intro for Professor Levinson. But before joining Loyola Law School, Professor Levinson was an assistant U.S. attorney in the criminal section in Los Angeles, where she served as a trial attorney and appellate lawyer. In addition to being one of the students' favorite professors, definitely the favorite Levinson, she's a prolific scholar. Professor Levinson currently leads the following programs at Loyola Law School: the Capital Habeas Litigation Clinic, the Fidler Institute Annual Symposium, and the Project for the Innocent. She is also my friend and mentor, and I am so glad that she is here today. Thank you for joining us.
Professor Levinson, thank you for having me.
Professor
you are
Levinson.
My favorite student ever.
There are a few 100,000 students weeping right now. So I want to talk today about the Project for the Innocent because I was lucky enough to attend a wonderful event last week where we heard from a lot of people who the Project for the Innocent have helped over time. But I first wanted to start out by asking, could you tell us how you first conceived of the idea of starting the Project for the Innocent at Loyola Law School?
Absolutely. You know, I have to give the students the credit. I mean, this was born of their ideas. You know, I have had over 10,000 students, but the ones who stand out are the ones who want to make a difference. And so we had some students, I had a few students who came to me a few years back and said, Professor, we want to make a difference. What can we do? We looked around and we saw that there have been people who have been wrongfully convicted, and that's something that we could get involved in. So we put together this little clinic, and we started helping people who had been sentenced to life in prison. Some of them had actually faced the death penalty. And in investigating, we found out that they were actually innocent. They had not committed the crime. There had been misconduct during the trials, and that we had to go back and reinvestigate everything. And this isn't as simple as what the public thinks, where you just grab the DNA and you have an answer. In 90% of the cases, there is no DNA. So it really involved the students going out, in our first case, to a whorehouse where the murder had taken place, interviewing everybody there, and finding out the truth of what happened. Since then, we have about 200 people on our docket, a half dozen cases in full investigation, and as you saw at the program last week, we've had other actual successes as well, and we're really proud of that. I'm really proud of the students.
Well, when I was in your evidence class and I met my husband, you never took me to a whorehouse, so I feel somewhat shortchanged at this moment. But can you talk to us about some of the higher-profile successes? I got to hear from them last week, but I think our listeners would love to hear. Let's start with the cash register case, because that was in the news. Could you walk our listeners through that case?
Right. Mr. Register, and his real name is Cash, with a K, just celebrated his first free anniversary, as we say, 1 year out of custody. You know, sadly, he spent 34 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. He was a young man. He was, I think, 18, 19 years old, living over near Hamilton High School on the west side of Los Angeles. And there had been a terrible shooting of a victim there, an elderly man. And the police went ahead and just sort of put together a case against him with no physical evidence, really, to say, but getting some witnesses that they were able to jam to say, well, maybe it was Cash. One of the witnesses was this woman named Brenda Anderson. She went to high school for a little bit of a time with Cash, and the police only knew from him. He had no real felony record. He had stolen some hubcaps. But they took out his picture, and she said, oh, yeah, I went to school with him, and that became he was the murderer. And then the second witness was somebody who, frankly, even though he testified at trial that he had run after the murderer, saw him face to face when the murderer was armed and he wasn't and could positively identify cash, when we went back and found that gentleman, he said, I don't remember anything like that. And so what we began to see is that the police desperately wanted to solve the case, but they didn't really care how they did it. We did the investigation. We had a lengthy hearing in front of a wonderful judge in Los Angeles. And luckily, at the end, he was exonerated. But I want to give you really what the key was. The key was that there was an honest prosecutor 34 years later who went through the prosecution's files and said, oh, maybe you should have this. They hadn't given it to Cash's lawyer all that time ago. But it was actually an internal memorandum by the DA's office where they were discussing whether they should seek the death penalty. And there was a line in there that says, but of course, the eyewitnesses cannot identify the suspect. Now, that is the type of thing that should be turned over to the defense lawyer. It never was. And it was really the key to showing that he never got a fair trial, and he isn't the one who committed it. And so we have a wonderful end to the story. Mr. Register, who's one of the kindest, most gentle men you will ever meet, did walk out of jail into the arms of his mom, who's been waiting for him all these years. She had his bedroom ready just the day he left. And he lives with his mother. He works at Costco in the warehouse. And he's trying to put his life back together now that he's 54 years old.
Well, it is an amazing story, and I really thank you for walking us through it. I'm sorry that all the listeners couldn't have been in that room to hear him talk about the Project for the Innocent and what the students did, and it really was a very special moment. And I want to talk about someone else who was actually in the room, another success for the Project for the Innocent. The Obi Anthony case, and that's actually that case, some of the players from that case are back in the news. Could you also tell us a little bit about that case?
Yes, I mean, Obi was our first big case. We did that in partnership with the Northern California Innocence Project, who are fabulous. And Obi was the shooting outside of the whorehouse here in Los Angeles. Obi had nothing to do with that shooting, but he was convicted based upon the testimony, frankly, of the pimp of the whorehouse. And this case was so famous or infamous that there was actually a former LA Times reporter who wrote a book about it. And we went back and read the book, and we saw things in there that seemed more than irregular. It talked about police officers pocketing bullet shells that had been on the top of the roof of the whorehouse. Now, nothing like that had been disclosed during trial. And so you know us, the students are out there investigating. I'm there talking to the pimp of the whorehouse. And we realize that much has gone awry here. That, in fact, the pimp admitted to us, and then during the hearing that we had on the habeas, that he had never seen this at all. That this was all made up. And that the police, frankly, sort of grabbed the local suspect. Obi was a local guy. Frankly, everybody in that area is in a gang, but he wasn't in a violent gang. He had a nickname, I think it was Little Day Day. The suspect had said it was Baby Day in gang parlance. Those are two very different people. But because people didn't care enough, they said he was guilty. And we actually went all the way to the south side of Chicago to find a witness that the prosecution never called, one of the other victims who had been shot. And call me suspicious as a former prosecutor, but I was wondering, why wouldn't they call all the victims? And when I found that gentleman, I found out why. It's because he said it wasn't Obi. And that was a spectacular but scary moment during the evidentiary hearing. When we brought in the witness, he sat on that witness stand, and the prosecutor said, and stood behind Obi and said, is this the man who did the shooting? Now, my heart stopped, and the witness took plenty long time to look, and he said, no, that was not the man. That's a Perry Mason moment, and thankfully, Obi was released. And now Obi is in college. He's doing quite well in college. He's doing legislative work for others. He earned several degrees in prison, and he's somebody who's just very busy, like Cash, helping others.
Well, in both of these cases, I mean, they're very uplifting cases, but they're also very depressing. And I think it speaks to a number of the failings of the system, which I hope are unique. But can you talk to us about, are there common issues that occur with these wrongful conviction cases? Are there, is it often eyewitness identification problems? Is it often a problem with the police? Is it prosecutors? Are there a few common themes?
There are absolutely some common themes, and we've learned a lot about this in the last several years. We know that eyewitness identifications are not reliable, and how do we know about that? Because we know that the high percentage of people who are eventually exonerated with DNA evidence had eyewitness IDs, and eyewitnesses are notoriously bad at making identification, especially of people of a different race. So a lot of these cases have that in common. The second thing they have in common, and some of them, are alleged confessions. But confessions by people who are young, mentally deficient, scared, those are not helpful. The third thing, and this is really common, is that they have people who are representing them at trial who just don't try that hard. What we call ineffective assistance of counsel. Lawyers who take the money and run but don't really put on much of a case. And finally, I would point the finger at prosecutors, because they do far too often withhold what we call Brady information, exculpatory information. And why do they want to do that? I think they just want to win so much. But it's damning. It's damning when the defense can't get the evidence that will exonerate them and can't get it for 15, 20, 30 years after the conviction.
Well, it certainly is damning. And, you know, now that you've laid out the problems, I think we have some ideas, but if you could wave your magic wand, what would you do to reform the criminal justice system? What would you do to basically put the Project for the Innocent all but out of business?
I would love to put us out of business. That would be fabulous. But there are many things that have to change, top to bottom. And every participant has to care. So I do think that it actually starts with the prosecutors. You have to create a culture where it's not important whether you get the conviction. It is important whether you get it right. I think you have to work on the defense lawyers to take this work seriously and not overextend themselves and not make prejudgments of their own clients and therefore to act effectively. I think law enforcement has to get on board. You know, a lot of old cops really thought it was their job to convict and only now are getting used to the fact that it's their job to help even the defense find the evidence. And finally, the court. I think many judges, maybe because they were prosecutors for so long or otherwise, are a bit jaded. Think that all these people writing from prison are, you know, just whiners and they're actually guilty. And I'm here to tell you that it's not our experience. I think the statistics show that up to about 5 to 10% of those people sitting in prison for a lifetime on serious offenses are probably not guilty. Now, that may not sound like a high percentage to some people, but if it's someone you know and love, it's really high.
Well, I think any percentage is should hopefully sound like too high a percentage, even though,
You know, this should be zero tolerance. So, you know, everybody, there is no, quote, criminal justice system. I hope I taught this to my students. The system is a people, and it's people wanting to do the right thing, and it's not easy. And some of this may not even be intentional, but it is real. And if anybody doubts, please come on down to Loyola. Meet our clients, meet our students, and I think you'll be convinced as well.
Well, I think that's such an important lesson. This is not just a foreign, you will never interact with the criminal justice system. This really is about people. And, you know, you were talking about the reforms, and the first reform you mentioned is prosecutors getting it right as opposed to getting a conviction. I know that certain DA's offices are doing this. Do you think that every DA's office should have a conviction integrity unit?
I absolutely do. You know, I took it slowly on this concept, but now that I've had a chance to study the conviction integrity units around the country, for heaven's sakes, if Texas can have one, California can too. And they're really helpful because the DAs there understand that their job is to undo convictions. Sometimes they're actually managed by defense lawyers. They're the purest form of collaborative criminal justice work that we have. In other words, there are no sides. It's everybody from involved in the case getting involved to get it right. So it's time to try it. not having conviction integrity units has turned out to be much more expensive, as we find out that there are people who are wrongfully convicted, and then they have actions after that.
Well, which certainly costs both in terms of money and, you know, other non-economic harms. And you mentioned judges, which I thought was interesting. It's probably a group that we don't talk enough about. What, as our final question, what can we do to ask judges to say, just because this person was convicted, please take another look. There might be something else going on here.
You know, I think that the bench is on a learning curve as well. I think that many of the judges never thought that at least they, as prosecutors, ever convicted an innocent person. But now they can't really say that. So I think having, we're in an election season, as you all know, the best expert in the business. And in this jurisdiction, we actually vote for some of our judges. So I think the public has an opportunity to really not just sort of check off a mark, but find out, based upon statements made by candidates or statements made by judges, whether they are objective. Their job is to get to the truth, not to favor one side or another, not to be the prosecutors they used to be.
Well, Professor Lori Levinson, I know from experience that you train great prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges. I am very proud to work with you at Loyola and proud to call you my friend, and I'm so happy that you shared your experiences with us.
And I thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Professor Levinson. And our next guest will be Fran Siegel after the break. This is Jessica Levinson. I am sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing, and our second guest today is Fran Siegel. I'm so glad she's joining us. She is the Chief Investment Officer and Managing Director at Impact Assets, a nonprofit investment firm seeking to increase the flow of capital to impact investing. She oversees the firm product development and heads investment management for the Giving Fund, a $150 million impact investing donor-advised fund. She has a BS in economics from Barnard College at Columbia and an MBA from Harvard University. Fran Siegel is an adjunct professor at the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies and a senior fellow at the Brittingham Social Enterprise Lab, both at USC's Marshall School of Business. Because we have a short program, I will just finally say she serves on the investment committee at the Goldhurst Foundation and on the G7 Social Impact Investment Task Force Working Group on Asset Allocation. Fran, I'm so glad that you're joining us. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
So, Fran, we've talked about this before, and it's sometimes hard for me to grasp the concept, but could you share with our listeners, what is impact investing?
Sure. Impact investing is a type of investing that aims to create a financial return as well as social and environmental impact. So when we traditionally think about Wall Street, our perspective on value is restricted almost exclusively to shareholder value. So we seek to maximize financial return for shareholders. Impact investors, alternatively, see the world in a more expansive way and see the notion of value in a more extensive way. So we move from a paradigm of maximizing shareholder value to maximizing stakeholder value. So typically the way money is made and transferred in our society is we invest in a company, we buy groceries, we buy products, we buy an education, and then we make money and we give money to charity, and we also give money to the government in terms of taxes. And so we see the way we make our money as somewhat divorced from the focus of our charitable intent, our social and environmental concerns. And impact investing really draws those two spheres together of financial return and charitable intent into a single practice called impact investing. I would say that the impact can vary greatly, but for example, a social impact might be jobs creation or financial inclusion for folks in low to moderate income communities, education, health, food. And on the environmental side, it could include access to clean water, clean energy, sanitation, timber, healthy fisheries. And so the point there is that with the impact in impact investing can be varied, and the investing part of impact investing still has all the rigor and analysis that you would expect from traditional investing, but with this additional philanthropic or charitable lens.
Well, I think that answers our next question, which is, how is this different from, I'm sure a lot of people say to you, you know, you're at a cocktail party, you're at an art exhibit, they say Fran Siegel, how is this different from traditional investing? And is it looking at things through this different lens? Is it a different purpose?
Yeah, very much so. I may have partially answered that question a moment ago, but yes, traditional investing, whether it's Wall Street or whether it's investing in private companies, tends to say, well, you know, how can I make as much money as possible? And then, you know, I'll write a check to my alma mater or my local food bank. And impact investing says, well, gosh, couldn't we also have accomplish impactful goals through our investments, so that giving is not ex post to making the money, but that you're creating simultaneous value creation or blended value. You're seeking to maximize a basket of financial, social, and environmental returns.
That I think that's so useful, because we hear so much about impact investing and what it means, and it's hard for people to place it on a continuum between traditional investing and then philanthropy. And, you know, I am hearing, not just because I talk to you, which is often the highlight of my day, but also because I talk to other people and I keep hearing the term impact investing. Why is this a growing area?
Yeah, I feel that there is a groundswell of interest in educating oneself about impact investing and practicing impact investing. And I think that there are a range of reasons. I think the predominant reason is that the social and environmental challenges of our time are enormous, pressing, and intractable. And I will say that traditional models of philanthropy, of grant giving, and of government aid are insufficient to move the dial on these pressing problems. So some of these social challenges are, you know, clearly familiar to you and your listeners. One is population growth. We have about 7 billion people on the planet today, and demographers predict 9 billion by 2050, with the vast majority of that $2 billion population growth coming in emerging markets. Three-quarters of the world's poor live in emerging markets, and they're poor farmers, largely subsistence farmers. That's from the World Bank. So, for example, if you care about rural livelihoods and poor, as well as food security, global sustainable agriculure might be an impact investment theme that you're interested in. Lack of access to clean water and healthy food and other, you know, kind of public health challenges. And on the environmental side, we have dwindling natural resources and biodiversity, increasing incidence of drought. We're experiencing a terrible drought right now in our own state of California, but also aging water and electrical infrastructure in the United States, and weak or maybe no water and electrical infrastructure in emerging markets. So the point is that there are these enormous challenges, but also opportunities. But I also think that the rise of interest in impact investing comes from a few other places. One is the growing disenchantment with the traditional financial capital markets. We all observed the Occupy Wall Street movement in the wake of the financial crisis. And I think the financial crisis itself created a breach of trust with the investing public. Dogged pursuit of returns quarter over quarter rather than long-term value creation. But there's also an increasing impatience with traditional models of philanthropy and government aid. I will also want to touch on what I call the millennial factor. So millennials, we know from many studies, are interested in working at places that represent their values, investing in companies that are consistent with their values. And so I think as the millennials rise, even more so than they are, the interest in impact investing will grow. And then finally, there's an increasing positive policy environment in Washington, where government agencies have been, the budgets have been slashed, and they are eager to partner with private sector actors that have mutual foreign and domestic policy objectives. And so I think that's why we see a rise in policy activities to support impact investing.
Well, that certainly gives us a lot of information for why this is a rising field and one that's certainly not dealing with any frivolous issues here. I mean, I noted that the top five problems you listed are population growth, the world's poor, clean water and healthy food, drought, electrical infrastructure. Can you talk to us about some specific projects maybe that you've been involved in or that you teach your students about that are smaller scale examples of these bigger problems that you're trying to solve?
Sure. I'd be happy to. There are a couple examples I can give. But before I mention them, I just want to, for your listeners, just make the distinction before I start between the public and the private capital markets. So the public markets are the big financial capital markets of Wall Street, where individual investors can invest in individual stocks and mutual funds. And there's this whole other market that we call the private capital markets, where folks invest in private companies, startups. These may be angel investors or venture capitalists investing in small companies that are growing. And one of the things that the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Studies in Kansas City did a really interesting study that said all net new jobs from the mid-70s to the mid-2000s, effectively all net new jobs were created by businesses under 5 years old. So when you think about American competitiveness, jobs creation, we oftentimes think about big companies and how they create jobs, but there are many, many jobs, wonderful jobs, that are created from small entrepreneurial ventures. And so it's really in this realm of entrepreneurial ventures that I'll share a couple of examples, one in an emerging market and one domestic. So there's a company named Sanergy out of Kenya, and the impact challenge that they seek to solve is lack of access to hygienic sanitation. So 2.5 billion people lack access to hygienic sanitation, and that is the second largest cause of disease in the world. So Sanergy, which again is a for-profit company that folks can invest in, but a private company, they design and manufacture low-cost, high-quality sanitation facilities. They call it a Fresh Life toilet. So they manufacture these toilets, and then they actually franchise them to local Kenyans in rural communities and villages where the sanitation options are very grim and the public health issues associated are quite bad. But it also, through the franchise, not only does it create a healthy place to go, but also it creates a job, a micro enterprise or a micro entrepreneur, if you will, in a rural community, so they're creating jobs. And so again, these local Kenyans franchise the toilets that are then paid for, and Sanergy every week at no cost to the franchisee collects the waste and then converts it into organic fertilizer and alternative energy. And so this is an incredibly virtuous company where they're not only creating jobs, they're creating clean sanitation facilities, but they're taking the human waste and creating positive byproducts out of it, again, both energy and fertilizer. So I love this example. We went to Kenya last year and visited with Sanergy, and they're a terrific operation. So that's one example that's an emerging market example. A local, more domestic example that I like to give is one called Revolution Foods. And here the impact challenge that the company seeks to rise to is that children in the United States are experiencing increased incidence of obesity and diabetes with very poor access to healthy food choices, especially in the inner city and rural communities. We talk about food deserts or food swamps, where really the access to healthy and excellent food choices are impeded, and at least in the inner city, there is highly subsidized junk food available. And so, having a healthy lunch or a lunch in school may be one of the only opportunities to get a really wholesome meal for these kids. And so, Revolution Foods was founded by two moms who went to Stanford Business School, and they had this bold vision to transform the way America eats by providing access to healthy, affordable meals in schools. And they currently now they've expanded greatly and received venture capital investment. And Steve Case of Revolution, the founder of AOL, recently invested in them so that they could scale. And now they serve over a million freshly prepared meals every week to over 1,000 K through 12 schools nationwide. So those are kind of two mini case studies to hopefully bring alive for your listeners the ideas behind impact investing.
It's certainly does, and I'm now jealous of all your students who get to learn from you and hear about these issues all the time, because now I know how lucky they are to be able to hear from you about this really important work and understand some of these examples and really bring it to life. So we have about 5 minutes left. I have a couple more questions for you. First is, it's easy to quantify financial returns, but what is impact and how do we measure it when we're talking about impact investing?
Yes, that's a really important question, and one that we think a lot about in impact investing, but we also think about in philanthropy, is how do we measure and how do we quantify impact, or what we call the impact return on investment versus the financial return on investment. And so I would say the first thing you would need to do is try to understand what impact means for you. And I like to say that impact is in the eye of the beholder, and it's very rooted in your deep-seated values of social issues or environmental issues. For us at Impact Assets, we have a very specific notion of what constitutes impact. For example, the ventures that we invest in and the funds that we invest in must deliver products and services that are impactful in and of themselves. So the impact must be released by the embedded in the products and services, and the companies must measure and report impact. There is an emerging taxonomy of impacts called IRIS. That's an acronym that stands for Impact Reporting Investments Standards. And it's a taxonomy of thousands of impact metrics that companies and investors can pick and choose from as a way to create a standard. We have the generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP, in the finance world, and that dictates how we report impact, how we report financial returns, and IRIS seeks to become the GAAP of impact investing so that that we can start comparing and contrasting impacts. And so I would say it's an art, not a science, and it's the practice is really emerging, but those of us in impact investing are spending a lot of time thinking about impact metrics, measurement, and reporting.
So you said those of us who are in this area, and I know, but you won't say it, that you're absolutely at the top of the field. And whenever people are in that situation, I always want to ask them, how did you end up here? So what was your career trajectory? How did you get started in this field? And we have, unfortunately, about 2.5 minutes for that question, but I want to hear as much as you can share with us.
Sure. I'd love to share that and maybe a resource or two for your listeners.
Please.
So I started my career in philanthropy and was really excited to be on the grant-making side, but became much more focused on what the investment could do. What, how is the endowment of the foundation invested? And so I went off to Harvard Business School to really understand if there were for-profit models that we could create and invest in. And the term impact investing was coined in 2007. I was in business school in the mid-90s, so it was kind of early days. But I ended up writing a paper for my venture capital professor that was a meditation on the nature of value, beyond, including and beyond financial value. And that paper really has formed the blueprint of my career, where, you know, since graduating, I've either been operating, consulting, or investing in for-profit impact ventures and funds, versus where I came from, which was traditional grant making. And now, I, as you mentioned earlier, I'm chief investment officer at Impact Assets, which is a nonprofit financial services firm dedicated to increasing the flow of capital to impact investing.
Well, that is a really exciting career trajectory. And, you know, I know you wanted to leave our listeners with some resources before we sign off.
Yeah, for sure. So if you're interested in learning more about impact investing, the Impact Assets website is a great place to go. We have a number of issue briefs and resources. That's impactassets.org. And then another terrific resource is thegin.org, which is the Global Impact Investing Network. And the URL is thegin.org. And then if I could just say that there's one terrific book for those who are even more interested in learning about impact investing, and it's called Simply Impact Investing by Jed Emerson and Anthony Bug Levine, and that is available, you know, wherever you buy books.
This has been so edifying. It's, even though we talk so often, I learned an enormous amount. As I said, everyone who gets to sit in your classroom is so lucky. Thank you for spending the time, and thank you for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jessica.
Thanks. This is Jessica Levinson. I am sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing. Joining us now is Carla Marinucci. Carla is the senior political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she covers national and state politics for the paper and writes the Spin Cycle Politics blog, which has been named as one of California's top political blogs, which indeed it is. In 2012, the Northern California Society of Professional Journalists awarded Carla its Career Achievement Award for her work covering four California gubernatorial elections and five presidential elections for Hearst newspapers. Carla has been twice named as a media fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. She is a featured political analyst on KQED, KTVU, and has been a guest analyst on CNBC, MSNBC, Fox News, Al Jazeera, as well as Oprah. And we are so pleased that you're here. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, Jessica. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you as we were leading up to the November 4th elections. They are fast approaching, and we talked about this earlier, but it seems like these are the no campaign elections. Why are candidates getting away with so little public campaigning? We haven't seen, you know, Governor Jerry Brown out there very much. We haven't seen Attorney General Harris, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, Mike Honda. Do we no longer care? What's happening?
You know, you have to worry about this, I think. Look, there's no big top-of-the-ticket race this year. We know Jerry Brown is, you know, ahead of Neel Kashkari, the Republican, by 20 points. And it looks like that sort of ho-hum has translated all the way down the ballot. Right now we're seeing a sort of non-races with Kamala Harris, the Attorney General, and Gavin Newsom, the Lieutenant Governor. And, you know, I think voters know less and less about who's running and why they're running. And I think we in the media have certainly a responsibility there. There's fewer and fewer political writers in Sacramento, and there's fewer and fewer people covering campaigns. And as much as people like digital news, I think they also like real political news. And, you know, we need to keep fighting to bring that to them, and we need to inform them. And I think we're all a little bit guilty here about an election where, in some cases, a third of the voters, I know in Oakland where I live, and there's a competitive mayor's race, more than a third of the voters say they know nothing about the race.
Well, I want to get back, if we have time, to this issue of voter information, because it's one that we've talked about a lot and that I think is really important. But you mentioned our favorite words, ho-hum. So speaking of ho-hum, the governor's race specifically, we have one candidate who, as it turns out, is the longest serving governor, who has $23 million but isn't really campaigning. And then we have another candidate, Neel Kashkari, the Republican challenger, with no money, but is really trying to leverage social media to the best of his ability.
Yeah, I mean, this has been fascinating. And his latest ad, I think, is another sort of example of a candidate trying to use viral, you know, media gone viral to his best advantage. This is an ad that in which Neel Kashkari shows a drowning child, believe it or not. And he sort of saves the drowning child and accuses Jerry Brown of betraying California's kids on the issue of education and teacher tenure. It's a shocking ad to watch, where you watch this kid drown for about 30 seconds. But then, you know, we're seeing ads like this all over the country. What candidates are doing, what Neel Kashkari is doing, is trying to, it's almost like a selfie campaign for governor, where he's doing shocking things like, you know, this ad, and like spending a week as a homeless guy in Fresno, which he did, because it gets him a lot of free media on the internet. He gets him a lot of hits. He goes viral, and it seems to be about going viral these days. I mean, Jerry Brown, as you mentioned, Jessica, you know, he's been out there 40 years in state government. He's not putting up an ad. He's not putting up a bumper sticker. You don't see a single poster or a billboard for him anywhere, and he's got $23 million in the bank. He doesn't need to. He just feels that he's going to be pushing some ballot measures, Proposition 1 and 2, the water bond and the rainy day fund, and he's not going to push himself. We've never seen such a non-campaign for governor from the top of the ticket in California. And you're right, the contrast with Neel Kashkari is just dramatic, because here's a guy who is still unknown by something like 75% of California voters. And he's doing everything to get attention. But this selfie campaign seems to be, it's a long shot at best still. It's one of those only in California kind of campaigns.
Well, I think we have our ultimate quotable quote from you, which is the selfie campaign for governor. And I hope this goes down in history as being named that. But so I wanted to ask you then, I mean, what does this mean for the future of campaigns in terms of social media? Does it mean that nothing, because Jerry Brown is such a popular incumbent and nobody has better name recognition than Jerry Brown because he's actually done this job three times?
Yeah.
Or does it mean that we're not yet at the place where you can run a competitive campaign trying to leverage social media?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that we're going to see somewhere in the middle. You know, I mean, look, you're right. Jerry Brown is so well known to Californians. He's held just about every political post there is here. Mayor of Oakland, you know, Secretary of State, Attorney General. We can go down the list. People have known him here for 40 years, so he doesn't have to advertise, but he should be telling people, you know, what he's going to do in the next term. He did one debate, and you mentioned debates early in this question. And I think that is significant at every level in California, because Jerry Brown did one debate with Neel Kashkari, and it was one, you know, done on a cable TV station in Sacramento on the first night of the NFL schedule.
Which, you and I were the only ones watching.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I mean, in the past, we would have seen a series of five or six good debates with these people. Gavin Newsom has gotten away with not a single debate with his lieutenant governor challenger, Ron Nearing, who is not no slouch. The guy was the chairman of the California Republican Party and has gone up and down the state sort of demanding these Lincoln-Douglas debates, which he's never going to get. Now, you know, you listen to political consultants and they say, well, look, why do these people have to debate Kamala Harris? Why is she going to give her challenger, Ron Gold, any kind of publicity? Well, maybe because the voters deserve it in some respects. I mean, these are job interviews. Every election is a job interview, and I think the argument is voters don't care enough to watch these. Maybe that's true, but I still think, as maybe I'm old-fashioned here, Jessica, as a matter of principle, I feel elected officials owe it to the voters to tell people where they're what they're going to do and to sit down and discuss issues with their opponent. And we saw that up here in the Mike Honda race with Ro Khanna. That's a very competitive race in Silicon Valley where you have two Democrats against each other. And Honda did one debate, had promised more, but has not made good on those promises. And in the old era, the media would be holding these people's feet to the fire, and they would not have gotten away with it. But they are getting away with it, and I think we're going to see less debates and less sort of public forums as a result. If these politicians can get away with silence, they will. I think in this, that's a sad thing to say, I think.
Well, how very quaint and old-fashioned of you to want the our elected officials to speak to us. What an outdated view that is.
It's so yesterday.
It's so over. But I think it's interesting that, you know, you said there'll be less debates if people can, if elected officials can get away with it. So what does get away with it mean in an era of, I mean, I think we're going to see low 30% in terms of turnout. Is that going to change?
Isn't that sort of outrageous when you think about the kind of turnout you can get in India, the world's largest democracy, where holding elections is much more difficult? I mean, I still think, and part of it is education of our kids. I mean, I don't know. I sit down with my kids at every election. We go over the ballot. Both of them are over 21. But we all go over the ballot. We talk about these things. I mean, since they turned 18, I've always said, you are going to vote. This is part of your rights and your privilege as an American. And I think people have to make it part of civic education. But schools certainly do, too. But people have to feel that their voice means something. And this is where it's up to all of us, but it's also up to the media. And I think in the case of debates, the media has to hold these people's feet to the fire, and I don't think that's been done this time around. I think politicians who haven't debated, who've been totally silent on the campaign trail, who haven't done town hall meetings, who haven't gone out there and talked to voters and have just sort of played possum and lay low, that is the safest way to win re-election, but it shouldn't be the way they win re-election. And that's part of our job as the Fourth Estate, I think. And certainly it's part of the voters' job to demand better. And
well,
they need to.
I hope that we collectively all do. And, you know, in talking about elections and ways to improve our elections, you know, one obvious way, of course, that we've been talking about is increased debates. But I wanted to get your view, because you have such a unique vantage point, on two recent political reforms. One is the top two primary, where we say any voter, regardless of party affiliation, can vote for any candidate, regardless of party affiliation. And then the top two vote-getters, and you were talking about the Honda race, proceed to the general election. Might be two Democrats, might be two Republicans, probably not in California. And then the other political reform implemented at the same time, taking the power to draw district lines out of the hands of the legislatures and giving that to an independent redistricting commission.
Right, and this is really, we're seeing the effects of some of these. And I think the data isn't in yet on the top two primary, but I am wondering if maybe there are some sort of unforeseen implications to the top two primary that have resulted in voter apathy. One of them being that there are no more third parties in the top two primary. Voters will get to vote for governor for either Kashkari or Brown. There's not a list of third-party candidates. They've been eliminated in the top two primary, and I think maybe that could be part of the equation. I'm not sure. It was designed, of course, to bring more moderate candidates into the mix. And I think it has done that in some respects. Let's take the Honda Connor race, for example. You have a more moderate Democrat against Ro Khanna, who's the favorite of the tech industry, against Mike Honda, the seven-term incumbent there. But then you have 19% Republican voters in that district. Will they turn out to vote? I'm wondering if it will kind of suppress the Republican vote. We haven't seen the effects of it all the way, and I know that folks at higher institutions of higher learning are all looking at it. It's been called the jungle primary in some respects, because what happens is, we should explain, the top two vote-getters of either party in the June primary go on to the general election, which means I believe there's 29 contests in California where it's Republican against Republican or Democrat against Democrat. So that has created many races where it is the same party race. And that leaves out the voters of the other party. I'm wondering if that sort of suppresses vote or makes those people less interested in getting out to the ballot box. I think we have still to see the true effects of it. But on redistricting, I think there's no doubt about it that the way that the system was done in California was the fairest possible. You had a citizens commission, and they really went to great lengths to be fair and try to figure out how to draw the district lines without the politicians being involved, without gerrymandering. And, of course, it's a very difficult job in California. But I think they did it in a really exemplary way, and that has created political challenges in some districts that have been totally redrawn up here in the Bay Area, several of them. And we're going to see also the effects of those new lines, I think, that is still shaking out in California. So, yeah, two very big changes, and I think in some respects we can thank Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger for them, that he was one of the forces that sort of put in play both of these. But and I think California will be changed because of them, but we really don't know exactly how much this changes the equation, probably not for a couple of elections.
Yeah, I definitely think we need to see these pretty big changes, as you said, play out. For me, you know, as someone who follows elections, I love it, and it's fascinating. But
yeah,
you did mention something. You said, you know, I wonder if the top two suppresses the turnout of the party who may not have either one of the top two candidates to vote for in the general. And, you know, in California, based on voter registration, that is those are typically Republicans. And I wonder, is this a year where we're going to get a Republican statewide elected official? Is it going to be Pete Peterson in the Secretary of State's office, or is it going to be Ashley Schwerigan in the State Controller's office?
Those are both really good questions. And this is where we've seen the top two primary put forward a more moderate candidate for the Republicans. And Pete Peterson being someone who has really been surprising in the respect that he's gotten the endorsement of most of the major papers in the state. Including the Chronicle in the Bay Area, he's a Republican. The fact is that Republicans start out behind the eight ball on these elections because they're 15 points difference in terms of voter registration. So they start out behind the eight ball there. They've got to make up that difference. Pete Peterson, being a Pepperdine University sort of civic engagement expert, he runs a institute there. He has gone around talking about how he wants to make that job less partisan. He's running against State Senator Alex Padilla. And I think Padilla is a little bit ahead in the polls, and we're going to see if Peterson pulls it out. If so, that'll be viewed as a very good sign for the Republican sort of comeback in California, where and they've had a low point. Even Kashkari's nomination as the Republican gubernatorial candidate, he's far more moderate than any Republican we could have expected in the past. You know, he is pro-choice, he's pro-gay marriage. That never would have happened before, and I think the top two primary has something to do with that. On Ashley Swearingen, the candidate for controller, the mayor of Fresno, which is a Democratic city, she's a Republican, but she's a moderate Republican does not, and the key in all these cases is none of these candidates on the Republican side now are stressing social issues. It was only a couple of years back. Remember, Jessica, when they were Republicans, we were talking about abortion, guns, you know. I mean, you'd hear these, so gay marriage. Those are not on the agenda anymore for these candidates. They are all talking economic issues. They're talking about taxes and growing jobs and business. And that may be a much more appealing argument to California voters. But the fact is, why does the Republican Party still have a chance? Latino voters. I mean, those are, 15% of the state's population, and the fact is that Latinos are still overwhelmingly Democratic, going back to Pete Wilson and the vote for 187. And I think where Republicans stand on immigration reform still is a hurdle for them to get the Latino vote. Unless they talk about a path to citizenship, I think that's a sort of a line in the sand for many Latino voters, and the Latino vote is going to continue to be the sort of thing that the Republican Party has got to deal with in California if they're going to make any kind of comeback. And we're going to see what happens. We could go into a series of, you know, generation of elections here where you see Democrat versus Democrat on all the top races, because getting a viable Republican candidate to run is getting tougher and tougher. Who wants to take on Mission Impossible, right? So we've seen this in the attorney general's race, where in the past attorney general was the stepping stone to the governor's seat, and you would always have strong Republican candidates running for that. This time around, Ron Gold, I think it's fascinating, Los Angeles area attorney, he has taken the position against Kamala Harris. He's for the legalization of marijuana, the recreational use. So you got the Republicans.
The new Republicans.
Yeah, he's for, and she's opposed or has been opposed in the past. That's an interesting twist. So, you know, California politics is changing slowly, and the Republican Party is changing slowly. It just may take them many years to rebound, and it's going to take a number of sort of reincarnations before they get there, I think. But you certainly have some leaders in the party that are trying to do that.
Well, in those years, I know who I will be reading to keep me updated on everything. Carla Marinucci, senior political reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle. Truly such a pleasure to talk to you. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, same, Jessica. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us, and I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Absolutely.
Bye. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, and I've been sitting in for Ian Masters. You can sign up for podcasts at ianmasters.com and stay up to date with my writing and tweets by following me at LevinsonJessica. Thanks to producer Graham Fitzgibbon, who did an amazing job. Bye.